Anaxagoras 10. Again, Edith is cryptically brief. Again, when so much may be said, she says so little. The irony of the personal genius, the paradox of her special wisdom, inarticulate when much may be expressible, articulate about matters which others find inexpressible. Again, because I was present either with her or with Zoe or was watching it from television, as the whole world was watching, I saw and shall report. Edith is fond of peeling the layer of surfaces off of appearances to show the hidden interconnectedness, contingency, and coincidence, to reveal how events, persons, and substance are colluded by events, persons, and substance. How by chance and choice, a confluence of opposite forces conjoin in conflicted harmony, like yin and yang, to manifest what is. Thus this day, thus the culminating event of August 28, began in past events, persons, and substances, by chance, by choice.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Being drawn, nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
It was over 1 year ago that first our epic protagonists met in Washington, D.C. to march on the Pentagon. By chance or choice, they met. I do not know the particulars to those events. One of these, a leader of notoriety and personal presence, a pediatrician philosopher, had famously written a popular child-rearing book which antagonists claim created the moral rot in America, corrupted its children. He advocated, it seems, that contrary to our heritage, we should spare the rod and spoil the child, whence we obtained the miscreant generation of youth, which should indulge itself in self-pleasure, drugs, sex, and rock and roll, and would be gamed by subversives to betray their nation and oppose the war. Of course, to protagonists, the moral rot of America is its legacy of slavery, its intolerance, its hypocrisy, the cloying affluence won by victimization and greed. What was entirely agreed, however, between protagonists and antagonists, was that America was morally rotten. By chance or choice, the pediatrician philosopher was removed from the interconnectedness, contingency, and coincidence of history's momentum. He was arrested early in 1968 and convicted and jailed for counseling youth to defy military induction. The woe of the pediatrician philosopher should have been a cautionary tale to Edith, who, you will recall, also counseled Howard how he may escape to Canada with her assistance. Edith naively publicly expressed opinions in opposition to the war, and in a faculty advisory committee to the dean had favored permitting demonstrations on campus, even granting space to groups who counseled resistance to the draft, and had indeed prevailed in her vociferous opinions against such antagonists as Dr. Rand and others, who, though themselves having never served in any war, esteemed the honor of military service, and encouraged the university to forbid all demonstrations against the war and the draft as un-American activities. But to return to my thesis concerning fate and free will, this pediatrician philosopher had been a principal protagonist at the March on the Pentagon, and had been assisted then by a scion of Quaker dissidents who have opposed war since 1776. A Catholic priest with nuns, some brilliant student radicals, some black power militants, a hip, obscene Negro stand-up comic, a beatnik poet chanting Om, and a swarm of dope-smoking, long-haired hippie rebel clowns who tried to levitate the Pentagon with the help of the beatnik poet chanting Om. After the pediatrician philosopher had been removed by the antagonists, the scion of Quaker dissidents, a couple of brilliant student radicals, and the most outlandish of the dope-smoking, long-haired hippie rebel clowns met, determined to continue, but being disenchanted with the two political parties which seemed likely at the time to re-elect the president who had led us into the war, or to elect an opponent who would widen the war, even to risk nuclear war, they concluded that the only strategy left, to choice or chance, was to disrupt the Democratic National Convention. Some who sympathized with the cause, such as Howard and Edith, determined to try to elect another candidate for president, such as McCarthy or Kennedy. Still others, such as Rachel, chose to, or chanced to, join the brilliant student radicals. Most of us did nothing at all. But events of chance, or choice, the ups, Johnson's leaving politics, McCarthy's challenge, Kennedy's candidacy, and the downs, King killed, Kennedy killed, threw all plans into a moil of chance, or choice. Hope and hopelessness were confused in chance or choice. As to the coming convention in Chicago and its subversion, plans were off, plans were on. They would challenge the party inside, they would challenge it without. They would reform it, they would disrupt it. They would show its moral rot by theater. They would show its moral rot by protest. They would show its moral rot in speeches, resolutions, politics, demonstrations. They would show the moral rot on television. But who was in charge? Not McCarthy. The scion of the Quaker dissidents? The brilliant student radicals? The dope-smoking, long-haired hippie rebel clowns? The pediatrician was in jail. The hip, obscene Negro stand-up comic was making caustic jokes, was ostracized, and could not get gigs. The Catholic priest with nuns was yet persisting in prayer for protests. No one really listened to the beatnik poet chanting Om, especially when he was chanting Om. Our mayor, His Honor Mayor Daley, did not fear the Quaker dissident, or the brilliant student radicals, or the dope-smoking, long-haired hippie rebel clowns. What His Honor feared was black power militants. What His Honor feared was that those adolescent but exciting protests would awaken the sleeping, coiled black dragon of the Negro neighborhoods, which, aroused and enraged, would fly out of its nest and set the city afire and bring the horrible Holocaust of the property of the white people. So, when he planned and prepared his response, he intended that it would be a savage and imperious and awful response, a reply in violent, ruthless power so swift and disproportionate that it would utterly dismay defiance and summarily and severely punish with contempt and conceit and self-righteous justice. His was the invincible hand of merciless God, and these opposing him were sinister sodomites. There would be 11,900 policemen with armor and tear gas, 7,500 Illinois National Guardsmen with tanks, and on standby at suburban naval posts, 7,500 army troops equipped with machine guns, flamethrowers, and bazookas. Even before the convention began, the police were working 12-hour shifts. At the height of the trouble, some policemen were on duty as long as 17 hours at a stretch, exhausted and tremendously stressed. So, from the beginning, by chance or choice, chaos and purpose were poised to collide. The protagonists, who were initially outnumbered by 3-1, were not given a place for foothold. No permits would be issued for protests anywhere, anytime. The city was fortified with barricades and barbed wire fencing. Curfews would be prosecuted, although ignored since the labor strikes of the early 20th century, archaic laws having been propitiously preserved to regulate would-be revolutionaries and anarchists once more. Welcoming the delegates on Monday to the National Democratic Convention at the Amphitheater, formerly the site of rambling Chicago stockyards and slaughterhouses, His Honor was politely received, and he bellowed into the microphone, "As long as I am mayor in this city, there's going to be law and order in Chicago." He pounded his fist hollowly on the huge stage podium. Some who had expected this cheered. Most of the delegates were talking among themselves, and perhaps they did not hear. I saw it on television with Edith. To this point, protests had been mild and savvy, for we all knew they would fail fruitlessly. The peace plank, calling initially for withdrawal from Vietnam, had been watered down politically. Well, it was a joke. It had started as a statement of condemnation, a call for withdrawal, some said retreat, and peace, some said surrender. But by a kind of smiling compromise only politicians can render, it artfully transformed itself, like a purse from a sow's ear, into a declaration trumpeting patriotic zeal and determination for victory at all costs, and a celebration of our heroic president and our boys over there. And it no longer stood for anything but a niggardly opportunity for a few persons to make statements of resistance to the war in speeches that might be shown on TV. And then again, they might be choked in the crib and never see electronic birth. The increasing polarity of the nation made those of us who opposed the war traitors, or nihilists, or subversives, although now even Walter Cronkite had openly said that the war cannot be won. The general public feeling was despair, even for those who supported the war. So on Friday, the previous week, the dope-smoking, long-haired hippie rebel clowns had held a countercultural convention and proposed a very ugly pig to be president of the United States. The Chicago police arrested it. And on Saturday and Sunday, before His Honor threw down the gauntlet, the scion of Quaker dissidents and the brilliant student radicals organized a festival of life in Lincoln Park. The beatnik poet chanting Om was there. Rock music was played for 5,000. On Sunday night, the police enforced the curfew in the park, but the crowd was gone. Photographers and reporters remaining in the park were clubbed by police. Foreshadowing what will occur, police pursued protesters outside the park who were walking about looking for open restaurants in Old Town and beat them with clubs as they were found. Anyone with long hair, anyone who looked like a student, anyone with a peace button on his or her shirt, or who looked like they may be from the university, might be clubbed. And so everyone ran from the police. There were no arrests that night. On Monday, then violence should commence earnestly. The restless youth in Lincoln Park began to feel confrontational, a reply perhaps to Daley's taunt that evening, or in angry response to the unexpected attacks of the night before. As the curfew approached on Lincoln Park on Monday night, some built a barricade against the police line. About 1,000 remained in the park after the curfew. A police car nosed into the barricade and was pelted by rocks. Police moved in by the hundreds with tear gas. Beatings began in the streets outside of the park, where the police pursued the youth. Again, bystanders were swept up into the fracas. Area residents were pulled off their porches and clubbed. More reporters were attacked that night than at any other time during the week. Tuesday morning, the photographs appeared in the papers. Papers were taken into the convention by delegates who felt the division of antagonists and protagonists among their own ranks rising. Conflicted over the protests and the police response, conflicted over the war. The lead of all national networks in the 6 o'clock news broadcast that night was film footage of the police assaults. Celebrity anchors at the network convention coverage, which began at 8 o'clock that night, aired the footage again, commented upon it, worrying that it would continue to happen that Tuesday night. But Tuesday had begun with a peaceful rally held at the Coliseum at noon. The beatnik poet chanting Om and the hip obscene Negro stand-up comic held a mock birthday party for President Johnson, an unbirthday party, as they called it. Later, 2,000 in attendance marched from the Coliseum to Grant Park. As the sun set at Grant Park, immediately in front of the Hilton Hotel, where the candidates, McCarthy and Humphrey, had headquarters and suites, and were in rooms overlooking it all, and where naturally the television cameras were set up and rapidly recording it, ready to go live at any moment by command of network directors, 4,000 demonstrators gathered to listen to speeches and folk songs. The commander of the Black Power militants spoke to the rally in the dusk. "Defend yourselves by any means necessary," he told his audience of white youths. Still, the rally continued peacefully. Meanwhile, in Lincoln Park, at the same time, a Catholic priest with nuns and 200 additional clergy and lay church people carried a 12-foot cross into the park, intending to erect it to support the 2,000 protesters and to remain in the park with them past curfew. Again, tear gas and club swing police charged the park. Many fled south to Grant Park and its sanctuary. What happened to the giant cross, I do not know. Perhaps it was arrested. Just before curfew, Edith, Zoe, and I went to Grant Park, a walk of just 8 or 10 blocks from her house, in order to bring blankets to some students whom we knew were participating there, Griffin, White Rabbit, Caterpillar, and Cheshire Cat among them. I stood outside the police perimeter and watched Edith pass through the folds of police legions at the edge of the park, who had assembled to surround it. Michigan Avenue was barricaded to the north and south, a block or two beyond Hilton Hotel. The police did not try to stop her as she went through their crowd, nor did they speak with her. Photographers took her picture with flash cameras. Television cameras may have also recorded her deed. Under the garish wash of Klieg lights, Zoe tried to enter the hotel to speak to Howard, who was working on some upper floor in the McCarthy campaign headquarters. But lacking credentials, she was brusquely rebuffed by a corps of police and Secret Service at the serial revolving door main entrance. Before Zoe or Edith returned, I thought I saw Rachel, with a red bandana about her forehead, needlessly taunting a sullen, fat, middle-aged policeman on the line. The police did not enforce the curfew that night in Grant Park. The protesters there, several thousand, smoked dope, played guitars, sang songs, and finally slept, some beneath the blankets Edith had brought. On Wednesday, August 28th, the convention shall climax. The peace plank would be debated, the candidates nominated, the roll call of votes called, and Humphrey was expected to prevail. For the protagonists in our drama, this would be a cynical anticlimax, a crucifixion of a dead victim, a numb self-mortification, an empty, mirthless laughter. For the antagonists, this would be vindication and vengeance. After dark that evening, Edith and I sat on her sofa and watched the NBC extended coverage of the convention, drinking gin and tonics. David Brinkley and Chet Huntley reported from their open-air balcony to the convention floor, speaking by wireless to reporters on the floor. The debate on the peace plank lasted almost 2 hours, much longer than Humphrey had wanted. His peace plank, which supports a continued war, had been challenged by a minority plank offered by McCarthy supporters. During the latter stages of the debate, an unidentified delegate was interviewed, poignantly asking us television viewers, while looking directly into the camera lens, how much longer must we endure this burden of immoral war? From the podium, Representative Wayne Hayes was giving his speech in support of the Humphrey peace plank. "I hope the Democratic Party does not turn the clock back to 1938 to send another Chamberlain to Munich to surrender to those who raped Czechoslovakia." What this meant here, I have no idea. But Johnson had used the same allusion to Munich and appeasement when he asked Congress to go to war in the first place. Apparently, it is a magical incantation for the Furies, the irresistible summons of berserker rage. Remember Munich. California delegate Pierre Salinger told another reporter a little later as the debate waned that Vietnam had motivated Robert Kennedy to seek the presidency. If he were here, he'd speak for the minority plank. Delegates around him cheered after this last remark. Anti-war banners were held up. The voting began. The speaker called on state after state. As the voting reached the end, the speaker called on Tennessee. Tennessee Governor Buford Ellington cast 2 votes yes and 49 votes no. The speaker called at last on Texas. Texas Governor John Connally cast all 104 votes no. At this point, the true peace plank offered by the McCarthy protagonists was declared failed. Having received 911 and one-fourth yes votes and 1,318 three-fourths no votes. The Humphrey plank was immediately affirmed by a raucous voice vote. On the floor, members of the New York and California delegations slipped on black armbands, and folk singer Theodore Bacall, a New York delegate, led them in the singing of We Shall Overcome. Others stood in the aisle yelling, Stop the War. The California delegation paraded the aisles with signs protesting the war. A priest knelt in the middle of the New York delegation to offer a prayer for peace. When he was done, people murmured Shalom and Amen. Singing continued for 15 minutes, taking up by more and more, by 10 or 12 other state delegations, and many individual delegates scattered across the floor. These delegates wept as they sang. The official brass band was directed by His Honor to loudly play a boisterous patriotic medley to drown out the singing. Some delegates left the floor to protest the loss of the peace plank, vowing to join protesters at the scene of the Hilton Hotel on Michigan Avenue and Grant Park. Edith put down her half-empty cocktail and announced that she would go down to the Hilton Hotel. Zoe, who had come downstairs to watch the vote, declared she would go with her. The pair then went to comfort Howard, mother and lover, and left me, old maid, aunt to no one and to everyone, to drink my gin and tonics in solicitous solitude, to witness the tragicomic mask which is my aggrieved nation, seen through the window of its soul, the veneered box of flickering electronic conscience, pouring over me against my will, and upon which I was compulsively and hypnotically arrested, either too drunk or too sober to turn it off. Alone in Edith's living room, sunk fatuously in her goose-down sofa, I numbly watched on television the dull train of gratuitous speeches, while the McCarthy nomination was seconded for yet the third time. Brinkley, as palled as I, stepped aside to interview the scrappy Georgia Governor Lester Maddox. He, who had famously defied the Civil Rights Act by chasing Negro customers out of his restaurant with an axe handle, thence shut his restaurant rather than serve Negroes, and ran successfully to become governor in his state, where the Confederate flag still officially flies in hauteur of the great lost cause. He decided just then to withdraw his name from nomination in the Democratic Party and to end his vainglorious presidential campaign. In a parting shot of phlegmatic contempt, he spat, "The Democrats are hopeless and good people ought to abandon them. The Democratic Party," he said, "is harboring communists, socialists, beatniks, and misfits. I'm going to go back right now to Georgia, and I will work for George Wallace to be our president. And I urge all Georgians to do the same." He turned away from the camera with a sneer and presumably lit out immediately for cornpone, moonshine, and the Swanee. News by radio broadcast that the peace plank had been defeated had already filtered through and piqued the crowds in Grant Park before Edith and Zoe got there. They avoided police presence, circling into the park from behind, walking the dewy lawns of the adjacent lakeside parks that stretched north of the Field Museum toward the Loop. Many hundreds of others, curious or committed, were also coming. In the end, the number of protesters, which had originally not exceeded 4,000, swelled to 12 or 15,000, youths and adults. Almost all of them were white. Many whom Edith recognized came from the Hyde Park neighborhood and from the university community. Professional peers, students, storekeepers, bus drivers, and so on, just ordinary people. She was, perhaps, one of the few middle-aged women present, but she was not alone. The police, for once, were outnumbered. But in anticipation, National Guard soldiers were deployed in phalanx of three or four lines behind the barricades. Klieg lights for the television broadcast glared across, flooded starkly the lines, the dense milling crowds, the grand entrance of the luxury hotel. TV cameras were prepared to send images to viewers of the illuminated Baroque bronzed canopy above the stately portal, and glimpses of the interior through its glass doors, the enormous luxury lobby, fabulously gilded, famously over-decorated in a plush expanse of faux Louis Cortez. By now, more than 7,000 demonstrators had gathered in front of the Hilton. Convention delegates who had marched from the convention hall were stopped at barricades by police and were forbidden to enter the hotel, although they were credentialed to enter. Police roved the street behind and among the phalanx of soldiers whose lines and barricades held the demonstrators at bay, filling the park before the hotel, spilling into the streets surrounding it. From above them now, McCarthy supporters were tossing things at the police. Water balloons. Hotel soap bars. Maybe feces in wads of toilet paper. Insults and name-calling were hurled from both sides. The din rose when paddy wagons were let through the northern streets to take positions, flanking the park along the northern wing of the hotel. Something planned must soon begin. When a young demonstrator wearing an army helmet started shinnying up a flagpole in the Grant Park bandstand to remove the American flag, the police charged into the park with batons raised, beating those who obstructed them. While this teenager was being dragged off, a group of young men, including at least one undercover police officer, as official reports would later admit, surrounded the flagpole and removed the flag and replaced it with a red T-shirt. General melee followed. Demonstrators threw asbestos floor tiles, balloons filled with paint and urine, eggs, and all types of stones. The police responded with clubs, mace, and tear gas. A police official testified to the federal prosecutors later that profanity and spitting did not have the same effect on the police that incidents involving the flag did. Abuse or misuse of the flag deeply offended the police. Hundreds of people, ranging from bystanders to militants, were now being clubbed and beaten. A smiling policeman said happily, "They're really getting scared now." One demonstrator heard an officer yell, "Hey, there's a nigger over there we can get." Police veered off and grabbed a middle-aged Negro man whom they beat. The crowd began to chant, "The whole world is watching, The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching. Meanwhile, as the nominating speeches ended, and I watched, voting began in the convention hall by the formal roll call of state delegations. The outcome was foregone. By tradition, as the inevitable victory should come, the states at the end of the alphabet began to pass so that the state of Vice President Humphrey might announce the deciding vote for its favorite son. But when the roll call turned to Wisconsin, whose delegation was expected to vote for McCarthy, the chairman of the delegation declared, "Mr. Chairman, most delegates of this convention do not know that thousands of young people are being beaten in the streets of Chicago." He demanded the convention adjourn. A desperate leadership at the podium testily declared him out of order. The continued broadcast of the roll call was interrupted. Suddenly, TV cameras outside the Hilton began to broadcast the fractious confrontation between the police and the protesters. For an uninterrupted duration of 20 minutes, the police riot, as it was to be famously called, would be broadcast live on every network, broadcast to every American household which had its TV set turned on, and broadcast live overseas by Telstar satellite to homes in Great Britain, Europe, and elsewhere, which were just then waking up for breakfast and the morning news.